is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, my great producers. I want to remind everyone, of course, we Zoom the show on Thursday morning, so if something should happen Thursday night, it will not be reported on our show for Friday. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Don't get tired of it. Understand the definition of patriotism. Know what it's like to have a spine. Remember what he said to his dad. All those things are so important, especially in light of what we're seeing right now with our president and Bill Barr and the Bolton book. Vindman's voice needs to be ringing in your ears when you walk into the voting booth in November. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States, so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I will be happy to answer your questions.
So I woke up this morning, Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock joining us as he does every Friday, editor of the Quorum Report, voice of Texas, dean of the Austin Press Corps. And all the conversation was about your state.
Of course.
It wasn't about the rains, because I guess it's really raining hard in places like Houston and they're worried about flooding.
It did this week.
And it wasn't about really directly electoral politics, which always concerns everyone because as Texas goes, so goes the nation. It was about the fact, and you even sort of said it, that Texas feels like it's on a precipice when it comes to COVID-19, because what we saw in New York is now knocking on Texas's door, only you don't have a Governor Cuomo. You don't have someone who's willing to sort of stand up to a president. You have a Republican governor named Abbott, and even worse, a lieutenant governor named Dan Patrick. So there has been so much mixed messaging, and now the worst has arrived.
Mixed messages, Arnie. We now have over 5,000 new cases of coronavirus per day this week as we really start to spike here. And you can look at the numbers, you see the data. It's just going up and up and up, whether you're talking about hospitalizations, new cases, and deaths from coronavirus. We're definitely going in the wrong direction. There's no question about that. Mixed messages. The governor finally starting to take a harder position on this. He has started to, you know, come to his press conferences wearing a mask along with his staff. And that was not the case for months as this was playing out. And we saw that the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, was at a Tea Party event in Houston. He was promoting pictures of it on Sunday in an email to his supporters. And of course, he was standing there with Dan Crenshaw and another member of Congress and some Tea Party folks and some people from Breitbart, not social distancing, not wearing masks. You say, who's leading Texas? You had a picture of Abbott with the mask, a picture of Dan Patrick, no mask, smiling with the Tea Party activists. And so who are Republicans listening to? The governor this week, there was a major shift in his tone about the way all of this is being portrayed to people. Arnie, he was telling people that, look, he doesn't want to order another shutdown of Texas. But in his news conference on Monday, it was the first time I had heard him say and repeatedly say, he said it at least twice, that a shutdown of the state was possible. He wanted that to be his last resort. But he said it could be possible because of the way the numbers are going. And we're seeing these spikes, particularly in urban areas in Harris County, where Houston is, Bexar County, where San Antonio is, Dallas County, Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is. And so this is a big concern. And we now see the governor shifting his policy a little bit. Remember when this all first started to unfold and the big shutdowns were happening across Texas. Big events like Rodeo Houston, which, you know, hundreds of thousands of people attend that. Same thing for South by Southwest in Austin. Both those big events shut down. Unpopular decisions made by local officials, county judges and mayors, who said that this is just not safe. And at the time, some people said maybe this is an overreaction. In hindsight, it was a pretty good move because at least until this point, we had not become a big hotspot like New Orleans had been, New York had been, the tri-state area, which you mentioned. But the governor then took authority away from mayors and county judges. Going back to April, he had said that he was suspending the portions of state law, which, again, this is, hasn't even been challenged in court that he can even do this, Arnie. But he said he was suspending the portions of state law that empower county judges and mayors to suppress disease, which it was, I think, an unprecedented move. We were researching this, trying to see if any governor had done anything like that before. And of course, since the Disaster Powers Act was passed here decades ago in Texas, we haven't had a pandemic since then. When they passed that, allowing for all these powers of a governor, nobody envisioned that it would be going on for months, if not years, without any legislative oversight, which is what we've seen so far. Well, now that things are going in the wrong direction, the governor is easing up on the mayors and county judges again. And just this week, he said that those local officials will be able to regulate gatherings of people, of more than 100 people at any one spot in Texas. And so just last night, Lena Hidalgo, who's the county judge in Harris County in Houston, 29-year-old Latina, who's been leading the third largest city, fourth largest city, third largest county in the United States through this. She was telling Rachel Maddow on MSNBC that if she had the authority right now to order everyone in the Houston area to stay home, she would do that. But the governor has said that she's not allowed to do that. And again, it's a weird, muddled situation, Arnie, because as far as I can tell, the Texas Constitution doesn't allow the governor to do this. But unless somebody pushes back, that's a situation that we are in. And the governor was really blasted nationwide. You probably saw on Twitter, it was trending that Abbott failed Texas and Abbott should resign. There was a thought that he was listening to data and doctors, that he was having that inform him, but he was also having the right wing of the Republican Party inform him. And something happened last week in Texas that was quite significant. The dark money group, Empower Texans, which we've talked about many times here on the program. You remember the lady in Dallas, the hairdresser who became the cause celeb for the right wing, including President Trump, was all fired up about the idea that this hair salon owner in Dallas was going to go to jail for having violated the pandemic orders of Governor Abbott. It was groups like Empower Texans, and they were leading the charge, tip of the spear, to try to get the governor to change his mind about enforcement. When the governor first laid out his orders saying that certain businesses could not be open, he had said that punishment could include jail time, fines, and possible loss of license. Well, these groups, and I'm bringing up Empower Texans for a reason, they have been just fomenting the folks on the right, who probably represents maybe 15 to 20% of the overall electorate in Texas. And of course, the governor very worried about that segment politically. Most of his career seems to be trying to stave off any kind of a primary challenge. And of course, he's not up for re-election this year, not up for re-election till 2022. But Empower Texans was shown to really have disdain for the governor in a way that I don't think that anybody anticipated. They have been complaining about his orders and saying that he's acting in a way that's not fair. Remember, the governor here has been taking heat from the left. They say he's moving too fast in reopening, and from the right, which says he's moving too slowly. At QuorumReport.com on Friday, we reported that these guys, and what is it with secret recordings in Texas, Arnie? Empower Texan staffers were caught on tape making fun of the governor for being in a wheelchair. You know that he's disabled from an accident decades ago. A tree fell on him while he was jogging in Houston. They were making fun of him for being in a wheelchair, calling him a piece of blank, saying F him. And they hate him and all of this. And one of their staffers actually said that usually it might be his instinct to make fun of somebody in a wheelchair, but he's able to turn that off because that's just not common decency. He can turn that off most of the time. But he said Abbott has been so bad on policy lately that he can't turn it off, that he felt compelled to just go ahead and just let it fly and make fun of the governor being in a wheelchair.
The policy can't handle the COVID policy?
that his COVID policy has been so terrible. So here's where I'm going with this. So the governor condemned them. A lot of Republicans condemned them for what they had said, for making fun of the governor being in a wheelchair. But think about it like this. On one shoulder of the governor, you have like the angels, like the healthcare experts, a former member of the House named Dr. John Zerwas, who has been trying to advise the governor on moving slowly and taking things in the right direction. And on the other shoulder, you have the right wing of the Republican Party and Power Texas types who have been urging that he move faster. And in fact, blew up his own plan when they did legal gymnastics to go ahead and open barbershops all over Texas to move faster than the governor had originally said he was going to do when he was listening to the better angels on that other shoulder. Well, on Friday, it seemed like when those folks were exposed as having such hatred for the governor that they were basically knocked off of that shoulder. And now the governor's going to kind of listen to the healthcare experts once again. He's liberated to do that. Problem is that this ship doesn't turn on a dime. This is a giant state, 30 million people, 254 counties across two time zones. And for the governor to now try to move us back in a different direction, to say, hey, you've all got to wear masks. I want you to do that. He didn't require it, but he's now stressing that people need to wear masks, not gather in big groups, stay at home if they can. Mixed messages, Arnie, like you said. The state's businesses are still open under his orders. So if he's going to go back in that direction of shutting things back down, which he has now hinted at, that he might have to ratchet back some of this opening of business all across the state, that's not going to happen instantly. And in the meantime, as we know, the disease is moving quickly. It is a disease that has what you would call exponential growth. So between Memorial Day weekend time frame and now, Houston has seen a doubling in its COVID-19 cases. 6 weeks from now, it won't be another doubling. It would be that it had grown by about eightfold, right? And so if things aren't changed, if we don't go in a different direction very quickly, the fact that now you are seeing the county judges around the state, especially in the big counties, once again empowered to go ahead and require masks, which they're at least doing for anybody who visits a business. You have that ability now in Houston and San Antonio and Dallas. Maybe that'll help to turn things around. The mayor in Houston, Sylvester Turner, almost begging people to put on a mask. They put out a PSA yesterday featuring some Houston Astros players and others saying, you know, wear it like a boss, mask up. You know, this, we all got to do this together. But if we don't, we are at the precipice. And things will only get worse if people don't start doing some different things. And the governor may have to go ahead and mandate some different things, which I think he's going to face a revolt. But think about the fact that in New York and in California, Governor Cuomo and Governor Newsom, for their COVID-19 response, the polling showed that they were getting big approval numbers from people, 80% or so for their responses. Even if everybody didn't agree with it, it's not like those guys escaped all criticism, right? I mean, people were critical of the governors, but most people understood. It was crystal clear what they expected people to do. For the most part, people did those things. We see the numbers declining in those states now. And Governor Abbott, if those guys were enjoying 80% support, the governor here was very concerned about that 15 or 20%, which Empower Texas is part of. And at least hopefully now they're out of the equation, you can start to move things in the right direction. The question is it too late?
There are so many things going through my head right now. And I want to remind everyone that one of the things that you've taught us is that Houston is really like a medical city, that it has more hospital beds. It has the biggest hospitals probably in the world.
Largest hospital district on the planet. That's
correct. On the planet. I want people to hear this.
So well, and things are so, and by the way, things are so strained in Houston. I've never seen this before. Texas Children's Hospital, one of the largest, if not the largest children's hospitals in the United States. They've for the first time started accepting adult patients, not just for COVID, but for other things because hospital capacity is strained. And we were hearing that in the next 10 to 40 days, depending on how quickly things grow, they could run out of hospital capacity in the Houston area.
Okay, two things. Have you heard the governor reach out to the Army Corps of Engineers the way that Governor Cuomo did in New York, where they set up those field hospitals, number one?
No.
Number two, there's the other storyline that we have a president who's in denial and is bored with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Of course, now we know that denial equals death, because it does. He's talking about shutting down the national testing sites, of which Texas has the highest number. Is mm-hmm. that actually going to happen? Cornyn must be apoplectic. because this is directly related to the feds. It's directly related to Donald Trump, who he has to run with on the ticket in 2020. And now he's talking about shutting these testing sites down when it literally is a meltdown in Texas. And as you point out, it's very difficult to turn it around. And frankly, given the size of Texas, given the fact that you have the highest percentage of probably even undocumented immigrants, if not the highest percentage, one of the highest, which means
California has a lot too, but yes.
They're in the shadows. And two, you have the highest percentage of people who don't have access to health insurance. So you've got the trifecta of failure, and now Donald Trump adds this.
I saw just yesterday a friend was posting on Twitter that they had to pay $250 for their COVID-19 test here in the Austin area. Members of the Harris County delegation to the legislature were asking FEMA to continue COVID testing in the area. Arnie, the president is really acting irresponsibly in ways that you don't see Republicans defending. When reporters in Washington have been trying to ask Republican senators about the rhetoric from the president, in a lot of cases, they just won't answer. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, just this weekend, the president hosted this rally where 6,200 people were there. And of course, they thought that they had a million reservations for the thing, even though, you know, you got to give credit to the K-pop kids and the kids on TikTok. Did you see that, Arnie, that these kids online were trying to fool Trump into thinking he had more supporters in Oklahoma than he thought? But the president had said, and then there was all this spin from the White House about it, he had said during that rally that he had asked his administration to slow down testing. Remember? And he said that, and you know, that was said to be a joke. Oh, he's just joking about, you know, slowing down testing. It's a really funny joke, you know, to say that you don't want to do as much testing for a disease that's killing tens of thousands of people all across the United States. It's a real knee slapper, Arnie, to joke about, you know, he said, I told them to slow the testing down. And some people cheer for this, but you did see, you know, maybe some cracks in the dam, Arnie. Did you see the video of people who were sitting in that arena who looked bored and they were looking at their phones and yawning? Because, you know, you go to this thing to, if you're a Donald Trump supporter, you want to hear him rail about the, quote, illegal immigrants, and you want to hear him talk about the wall and rail against China. And instead, for about 5 minutes, he was explaining why it was so hard to walk down that ramp at West Point, which is just a bizarre thing to be sitting there listening to. If you were listening to that, you couldn't get out of there fast enough, right? I mean, get me out of this situation. We've all been cornered by that guy at a party. So you look at all this, and the folks in Houston and in Dallas in particular asking, here was the quote from a letter yesterday from lawmakers at Republicans and Democrats of the Texas legislature. They asked FEMA to, quote, provide your full commitment and authorization for continued support through FEMA for the COVID-19 community-based testing sites. In other words, do what you said you were going to do. This isn't something that they had sort of hoodwinked the administration into doing. This was the commitment that the administration had made to keep testing going. And when the president, who always says the quiet part out loud, when he said that if you have more testing, you're going to have higher numbers, and so maybe I say, hey, let's slow all that down. Forget about the spin from the White House, Arnie. This move by the administration is the embodiment of what he said at the rally, right? That he would have them slow testing down in an area like Houston where we're seeing exponential growth. And as the county judge in Houston said yesterday, people in the Houston area want to help each other. We saw that during Hurricane Harvey, for example. And she said, this is like an invisible hurricane where your home is flooding or your neighbor's home is flooding. You want to be able to help. But the only real help now is for people to stay away from each other. And okay, we don't understand collective sacrifice in this country. I was trying to explain this to somebody, Arnie. We don't get it, right? Rugged individualism and self-sacrifice, those are American values, and they're good values. I wouldn't argue otherwise. But the pandemic turns that on its head, because you're not doing a deal where, hey, you know, I'm going to sacrifice my health to save other people. The whole idea is you have to stay healthy to keep the next person healthy in the chain, right? That's difficult politics for a lot of folks to navigate, because it's just not their understanding of how the world works. Well, it does now.
Okay, so I have a question to ask you, because I'm trying to figure out who has the higher authority. So you sent me a note and you were saying that the position of the chairman of the Texas GOP says that next month's party convention will not require mask wearing.
Yeah.
Now, it's happening in Houston. Just talking about the Harris County judge. Will she have authority over that event to require something that, even though the GOP chairman says will not be required, she's actually up higher up the food chain, and you know he can say what he wants, but if you're coming in our county, you're coming into Houston, you're wearing masks.
So the governor in his revised order this week said that mayors and county judges would be able to regulate events that are outdoors, which the convention is not, and is more than 100 people, which the convention is. So there is some question about this, Arnie. I'm not sure if the mayor, Sylvester Turner, or the county judge, Lena Hidalgo, will have any say over exactly how they run that convention, since it's an indoor event. Okay, based on what the governor had laid out, you can expect at the RPT, the Republican Party of Texas Convention, there would be about 10,000 people at least on hand for that. As we've talked about before, it's the largest political convention in the United States. It's about 2,000 more people than the Republican National Convention. And the only larger convention on earth is the Communist Party of China. And so you have all these people who are going to come in. Now, given the attendance we saw at the Oklahoma rally for the president, I don't know that many people are going to show up for this thing. Just anecdotally, I've talked to Republican staffers and activists around the state who normally would obviously go to the Republican Party of Texas convention, but many have said that they don't want to go. They don't want to be there. They think it's going to be a COVID-19 distribution facility at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston. So we'll see. I am going to check on, after we get off the air here, I'm going to check on the bookings at the hotels in the area to try to get a beat on this, because usually, you know, a couple of months out from the convention, it would all be booked completely. Last week, I had checked on downtown Houston hotel listings, and they seem to need people to come around that time. So I'm not sure a lot of people are booking their rooms just yet to go to this thing. It will be fascinating to see if it actually happens. But the Republican Party chairman, James Dickey, even after the governor started to take this different tone on the wearing of masks, the chairman continued to say they were not going to require that people wear masks, but he said that masks would be, quote, respected if people choose to wear them.
Respected. Oh, that's so we're not going to put a target on your back if you wear them. Like somehow you're a liberal. We're going to say that save your health and save the health of the group.
Look at some of the stuff that's happening around the country. In Ventura, California, you saw that woman who was railing against the city council there. If you haven't seen this video, you got to look at it, Arnie, where she sings God Bless America, and it's a rousing rendition of it. She doesn't want to wear that mask. She says, I'm not a terrorist. I'm not somebody into BDSM. I'm not somebody, you know, needs a mask. I'm a healthy American. I'm a Trump Republican yearning to be free again. That was basically her speech. And then you may have seen Palm Beach County, Florida. I think this was yesterday. The video of this is amazing. One person after another gets up in front of the county commissioners there and says all sorts of just flatly crazy things, Arnie, about how this is not what God wants us to be doing. One of the women who was testifying to the county commissioners there said that they were circumventing God's plan for the way that we breathe by asking people to wear a mask. One person said that citizens would start citizen arresting each other if they saw them wearing masks. It was so over the top. Where is this coming from? Well, you know where it's coming from. It's coming from the top, where the president absolutely refuses to wear the mask and has made it such a political issue. It would already be a difficult enough ask to try to get people to wear a mask anyway. Right, Arnie? I mean, it's not something that people naturally want to do. It's uncomfortable. It feels silly when you walk around with the thing on. I mean, I get it. But as Matthew McConaughey, the great Texas Longhorn and movie star, keeps saying in all his little videos, it should be a badge of honor. You're not wearing it for yourself. You're wearing it for everybody else in the community. So let's all get through this together. The fact that people are so opposed to it, I think that'll be on display at the GOP convention for Texas, for the state party in Houston, if it happens here in a few weeks.
So the governor will approve a super spreader event in Houston that his own party is going to own. I just want everyone to hear this. This is a super spreader event. Masks will be tolerated, all right, not required. We're talking about potentially thousands of people. It will only be Republican people. Let me remind you of this. Mm-hmm. So this is now completely attaching super spreader, death, COVID, to the Republican Party that ignores the idea of social distancing and mask wearing. I mean, that's great to have it happen next month. It's even better because it happens before November. Because if I want to do a split screen, I'm showing that event, I'm showing the number of people dead, I'm showing what's happened to the economy, and say, you want to vote Republican? This is the consequence.
No idea how this is going to go. And, you know, to the politics of it, the Democratic leadership in Houston, including the mayor and county judge, they may want to, you know, make the point that you just made. I can imagine, and I'd be speculating, but I can imagine that Sylvester Turner sitting in his office thinks, you know, let it play out. Let's see how this goes.
But the reason why Sylvester won't do that, Sylvester Turner, he won't do that because the health and well-being of his community is at stake. And
we'll
even
see.
Though it's good politics, perhaps, for him, it's good politics for the county judge. It may be good politics for Joe Biden. It is horrific humanity. It is horrific when it comes to the health and safety of your people. And frankly, if I were him, I'd say, look, you're giving me a political asset. I don't want that asset. I want my people to live.
I am going to be fascinated at how this plays out, Arnie. Every day I get questions from folks. Is the Republican convention still on in Houston? And the answer so far is yes.
And on that note, the answer is I need to say au revoir to one of my favorite guests of the week. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, take care of Texas, and the dean of the Austin Press Corps. We will talk next week. Please stay healthy.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
Ciao. Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back.
Technology goes out on a limb for clean water on this CurrentCast. Trees slow, absorb, and purify rainfall. That helps decrease runoff and stormwater pollution. Now, a software tool called iTree Hydro helps city and regional planners measure the exact water benefits of tree cover versus impervious services in their community. Ted Andreni of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry says by simulating the impacts of adding more trees,
the model will illustrate reduction in the total volume of stormwater, the slowing of the peak stormwater, and a reduction in the total amount of pollutants in the stormwater.
This provides information that communities can use to better protect their local waters. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Side of the day.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, her great producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other Friday, we are very lucky to be joined by Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the governor of Connecticut.
My next move.
Your next move. No. We just did Texas, so Texas is on my mind, honey bun. Anyway, Bill Curry ran for governor of Texas twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has written for Salon.com and many other journals, and he is one of the best progressive commentators, I think, in the country. We are very lucky to have him on such a regular basis because I love to mine his mind, and that's exactly what we get to do. So, Bill, you sent me this laundry list of things that are sort of front and center for you. I will let you start where you need to start, but what we know about Tuesday's primaries and what has happened really even just before Tuesday's primaries is that we've seen a real shift towards progressives. Progressives have done a pretty outstanding job of either really winning or coming so close in places where they shouldn't have even gotten beyond like 20% of the vote. So we know that there are undercurrents within at least the Democratic Party that are demanding more than just pablum DNC material, but they want something that looks more like change. And that was especially true, for example, in New York, where Engel, who has been around forever, is about to say au revoir to his committee assignment and his position in Congress. So you can talk about race and economics and what happened from an electoral perspective, but there is so much on your plates.
Let's just talk about that for a second. And one of the first things that's been really hard for especially establishment Democratic strategists, pollsters to understand is that those same progressive messages, those core messages of economic justice regarding the distribution of wealth, income, and opportunity in America, and political reform, the curbing of corruption, and the defense of democratic values, that those aren't just the values that motivate progressive primary voters. They are the values that motivate swing voters, including white working class voters. It's why Donald Trump switched from anti-trade ads to drain the swamp, and ads that could have been written by Bernie Sanders or me, for that matter. And he didn't mean a word of it, but he did. And so we also saw the Obama campaign, the two most historic presidential campaigns of our lives were Obama and Trump. And each one's closing argument was about curbing corruption in Washington. And so I would just say that I am so thrilled to see the increased sensitivity to racial injustice in America in these last few months. I think something has changed. At the same time, I think that we need to continue to frame this overall message and not lose sight of those core issues that animated the Sanders and Warren campaign and that are at the heart of the concerns of African-American voters as well as everybody else.
So let me just share something. So what we saw was they looked at 2018 and the number of individuals of color that had run, Hispanic, Black, Asian, whatever, they saw a huge spike from 2018 to 2020. That it went to, I think there's like 31% of the candidates that ran were African-American, Hispanic, Black, mm-hmm. whatever. And that what was really interesting was not only did you see a significant increase from 2018, and 2018 was a pretty high number. So that's the good news. What was also a really wonderful story is that they won at the same percentage as white candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did they run, but they won. So being there is terribly important, everyone. I just want people to know, if you don't run, you can't win. And so the good news is they ran. And the other thing that I thought was really fascinating is to look at some of the people that did run and what was their background. The big story coming out of New York is the former school teacher principal that took on an established Democrat and comfortably won. And when you ask him why he was running, it was his experience in education. It was his experience with his community and his students and his parents. And that's just not a race story. That is an economic story because he saw what was happening for them. And that's what made his voice so resonant with the community, no matter who you were.
We pigeonhole all these candidates as if for the convenience of pundits.
Yes.
And we miss the complexity of who they are and of their message. Every progressive I've ever known who went door to door to win public office had to reassure people that they understood the fiscal consequences of their programs, that they really knew how they worked, that they were committed to keeping them safe. We all ran on those promises, as well as trying to outline a larger progressive vision. In the 2018 congressional races, the great majority of the post-election analysis has said that the progressive candidates were only a small percentage of the winning candidates that turned the House. And I can tell you, from having read the websites and gone on the websites of all those quote-unquote moderate candidates, that their attitudes about political reform, corruption, ethics, that their commitment to living wage, their commitment to changes in the tax structure, and to all manner of populist and progressive themes, they were careful about cultural issues. They were careful about all the things that had been used to trap Democrats in who were running in difficult districts all, you know, through much of our lives. And they were sometimes too careful. But the bottom line is that to call those the moderates misses the point of the extraordinary shift toward a more progressive view of economic justice and political reform in America. Just misses it. A lot of them don't fit that, but most of them are as progressive on many of those issues as anyone running.
Exactly.
So we totally missed the centrality of this in the appeal of Obama, in the appeal of Trump, in the appeal of our 2018 Democratic candidates. My great worry is that the Democratic Party has amnesia about corruption, that they forget their own commitments to it. They forget how much the public cares. Schumer and Pelosi promised it would be the number one issue in the 2018 campaign, and then only brought it up in districts where the Republican incumbent had been indicted. They made it the number one issue they introduced in 2019 in the House Resolution 1, and then barely mentioned it again. There's something to be said. Schumer and Pelosi, in large part, obtained their leadership positions by fundraising. They were both major fundraisers, Pelosi for her party, Schumer for himself. And Biden has been an avatar of pay-to-play politics. There are many other good things about him, but boy, that's what he's been. And as a progressive right now, trying to think about what are the things we have to lock down as we go forward here, we have to recognize that liberal media never pays enough attention to corruption.
Yes.
That the leadership of our party doesn't, and that many of our own liberal institutions, the AFL-CIO, a whole host of advocacy groups, the institutional left in Washington has never cared as much about this. And of course, the debate in the post-George Floyd era has moved to other issues that are of extraordinary importance. We want to make sure that what doesn't get lost in the shuffle is the reform that is a linchpin to all reforms. And that is getting private money out of public policy, of standing up to the fundamental corruption of our democracy, which is the corruption by corporations.
I think AOC's win on Tuesday.
So that's something I think that we have to attend to in the next few months.
Absolutely. But here's the good news. AOC won by over 70% of the vote. I mean, it was, and she was running against a Wall Street darling. That was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
That was amazing. And then when you look at Engel's loss, and yet who endorsed Engel? I mean, everyone did. Hillary Clinton did. Chuck Schumer did. I mean, it's amazing. And yet he lost. Okay, and he lost to a black school principal. I mean, you know, with no political history, but obviously a connection to community, which is so important. And when you look at what's going on, even in Kentucky, that is going to be an interesting race. We're going to have to wait for the absentee ballots because it's still pretty close. I'm looking at all this, and what I'm going to say to you is the following, is that I think you're right about Schumer and Pelosi, but they also are good political tea leaf readers. And why I say that is Warren understands corruption. Katie Porter understands corruption. AOC understands corruption. Bernie's going to still be there in whatever capacity, and he understands it. And so I think what you've got now is people who are actually on a par of being powerful, in demand, getting airtime on MSNBC, getting airtime on CNN, understand when these people don't get time on TV, their issues about corruption don't percolate up. But if they're going to be given time now because they're so in demand, I think that level of corruption finally gets into the headset of the Democratic Party, not because they want it, not because they like it. It'll mean making money is harder, But guess what? I think they're going to be forced to hear it.
First of all, I think that about the entire progressive agenda. I think it a little less about corruption. I know they're going to hear it on police reform and prison reform and criminal justice reform. I know they're going to hear it about financing higher education. I know they're going to hear it about health care. I know they're going to hear it about climate change. When I ask myself, well, where will this issue, which is fundamental to all the other issues, where will it come out? Again, knowing that I agree with everything you said about all those people. And by the way, parenthetically, Jamal Bowman, like Alexander Ocasio-Cortez, this is another natural talent. I think he's going to have a real impact. Good on New York for producing two such people in these two cycles. I think that there is a question for all of us about making sure that we take this. You know, it used to be when I was starting out in the mid-19th century in politics, people would talk about these issues as goo-goo issues, good government. It only matters to the League of Women Voters. It only matters to Common Cause. No one cares. Biggest lie in politics. Again, as Obama and Trump both found out, and as many polls, Scott Rasmussen did polls, and there are all kinds of polls, when people finally ask the question, voters say it's the thing they care about most. And they're right. You know, why are we the only nation in the world betting on coal and rolling back fuel efficiency standards? Why do we have the worst healthcare system? Because our democracy is corrupt. It is fundamentally, cancerously corrupt. And so I just think it's important to us as progressives. And I also, and by the way, everybody you mentioned has been part of the progressive electoral political wave of candidates and leaders, not institutions, not the media, not the labor unions, certainly not the leadership in Congress. These are all the progressive insurgents. And as I said in a little note to you, it's up to Bernie, it's up to Warren, it's up to Ocasio-Cortez. It's up to those leaders to just stop and say to Biden, by the way, don't think for a moment that what Obama did with his political reform agenda, which is that he ditched all of it. He ran on it strongly.
You're not going to let them.
Almost exclusively. And then he dropped every single proposal. He didn't implement one. And most of them he couldn't do by executive office. So this is one of the areas in which I just want to sort of tweak our progressive movement and say, by the way, remember that whole thing about corruption? There's a lot in our minds right now, but don't lose sight of its value as a political message, and don't lose sight of the fact that it's indispensable to other reforms.
Actually, maybe I should start selling the bumper sticker. Don't forget corruption.
Yeah. I'm
dead serious. And the reason I say this is Elizabeth Warren used that word more than all the candidates put together. You could put Harris, you could put Biden, you could put Bernie even. That was a word that was really in the fabric of her DNA and so much of what she talked about. In part, why? Because her experience with Wall Street. In part, why? Because she saw the corruption. She saw how it corrupted. She saw the revolving door. She saw the money. She gets it. I don't think that she will put it aside. And I think she will look at Joe Biden and saying, I will work with you, but every other word out of me will be this word. And if you ignore it, it's going to become more and more obvious that you're not addressing it. We've always sort of, well, it's Obama, I got to work with Obama. Oh, it's Clinton, I got to work with Clinton. I hate to say it for Joe Biden. It's going to be Joe Biden. Oh, by the way, Joe, are you going to do this? Oh, by the way, Joe, are you going to do this? I think it's going to be a very different relationship.
Yes, everything's changed. We have a much stronger progressive base. And even more important, the country has moved in our direction on so many issues. If Joe Biden, who is in many sense kind of a mediocre candidate, I don't want to talk a lot about it between now and November, but he's not the most charismatic guy.
The right mediocre candidate. Remember?
Yes, absolutely. But he could become one of the half dozen most historically significant presidents of this country. And if we just take, if we, again, progressives could just remember, if the problem with the 2008 Obama platform, I would ask anyone listening who's doubtful about this, go back and read the Obama platform of 2008 and realize that if only he'd meant it, it would have been an extraordinary, it was a wonderful blueprint for the changes we had to make. And the problem is that we didn't realize how much of it was stuff that was sort of, to him, nothing more than boilerplate. His heart wasn't in it. He didn't do it. And now just put that aside. If we took the Biden platform, if we took the consensus of the Democratic Party right now and got it done, and just got it done with a little bit of tweaking on taking healthcare a little further and a few other things, that consensus would be certainly the most important legislative achievement in a half century. It would be the kind of thing that only happens every 50 to 80 years. It's all queued up. The public wants it. The Democratic Party's in agreement. The broader public's in agreement. We've espoused it. If we take the Senate, the question will be whether or not we deliver. I'm not so concerned about what's in the platform as I am regarding whether the people who adopt it really mean what they say. That's the question here.
You know, it's interesting. There was an article at the Marshall Project, and I think it was based on an article also at Mother Jones. And I just want to touch on this for a couple of reasons, because it's about really defining what is corruption. And here's the title of the article. These political candidates are embracing their criminal record. There's a picture of a man and a woman, and, you know, one of them got caught with drugs, and they ended up, you know, going to jail, paying off their debts, going to law school, doing all these things, and recognizing what got them to where they were, understanding the criminal justice system, having lived it, and now wanting to run for higher office, embracing that history, embracing that knowledge, and saying, look what I can bring to the table if we are going to fix some of these underlying problems. And I said to someone, I think this is phenomenal. Because think of the people in 2008 that took us down to our, you know, economic knees, who never went to jail, who didn't do a perp walk, who in fact are richer today. And somehow the fact that they weren't, you know, accused of criminal activity doesn't mean that they didn't do things that were probably illegal. But they walk out and everyone says, oh my God, imagine what it'd get if they ran for office. And then I'm looking at them, these people that are running, embracing their criminal record. And in a lot of ways, it's about defining what is corruption. These people are not corrupt. These are the people that are actually going to lead us into a sort of a better policy agenda. But the people who are corrupt are the people that didn't do the perp walk, that know how to write the checks, that know how to infect our democracy, not so that it celebrates opportunity and choice, but in fact, because it's all about a check with a comma in it. And I love the split screen of these individuals who are running, embracing their criminal records. And in a lot of ways, it's so stature enhancing, Bill.
First of all, I agree, too, the greatest problems in the corruption of our country pertain to things that are not, in fact, illegal. They're just wrong.
Exactly.
And so we have to make sure that what's wrong is made illegal. One of the great gifts of the Trump era has been to tell us how many of our traditions and protocols we can no longer rely on. How much of, for instance, the division between the White House and the Justice Department, how much of that has to be spelled out in black letter law. We've learned a lesson about so many things, and that's one of them. And the second lesson, by the way, is, and again, one of the mistakes that Obama made was not going back, and I've talked about this before in your show, but not going back and investigating Iraq, not going back and investigating Wall Street. William Barr belongs in prison.
Yes, he does.
What he's done here is phenomenally corrupt. Donald Trump belongs in prison. I hope he lives a long and healthy life, long enough to end up in jail. If he lives long enough, I think he may sample our federal prison system.
And his jumpsuit.
Yeah, he'd look, boy, it'd be hard to pick his, well, never mind. But
no, no, well, I apologize.
He blended into the... But this is it absolutely is important. That part of what holding the Democratic Party leadership accountable on corruption means is insisting that there are real investigations, that we don't do what we did with Iraq and with the Wall Street meltdown, that this time we really do a look back. We owe it to ourselves. We absolutely need to do this. And again, there are things to work out. We need to set up a mechanism to do it. One of the things that Trump has done is politicize the political justice, the criminal justice system and the entire judiciary in a horrible way. And we want to make sure we do the opposite of that. That means that no appointed Democrat should be going after anybody, but that we should have nonpartisan civil servants empowered to root out both present and past corruption and bring the culprits to account. There needs to be a new proposal. I've been writing a little bit about it myself, but this needs to happen. We need to set up and be ready with a mechanism that, again, without fear or favor, will do what we'd always counted on our Justice Department to do, but can't right now, and without any kind of reward or punishment coming from the elected Democrat. If we just set those people to work, I think they'll do the job.
So, you know, one of the things that's been so interesting about the whole Black Lives Matter, what's been happening over the last couple of months, is that not only has it exposed, you know, the the police and the economic injustice, but we're now finally beginning to sort of look at a history we've never been taught. You know, it's the idea that we've had a whitewashed history. The people that have written about it have been, as people say, the winners, and the winners have been white men. And now we're going back and realizing the pattern and practice that has created this huge wealth gap, the pattern and practice that has created this huge health gap. And we've had to go back and actually reacquaint ourselves with history that we were never taught. Not that it didn't happen. It just wasn't in our textbooks and no one took the time to teach it. The idea of the investigations you're talking about, Bill, guess what? Those investigations are history lessons. They have to do those investigations, because if we don't do those investigations, we won't know the facts and the truth and the true history of what happened. And so it's not an investigation to get you. It's an investigation to understand the history that led to this moment. And just like we're rewriting our textbooks, and just like we're rewriting and re-understanding about the policies that undermine so many people in this country, you know, that targeted them. It wasn't just redlining. There were so many other things that happened that we were just so unfamiliar with. I really do think that what Black Lives Matter has done is that it's liberated us to begin to have those hearings, not because they're a gotcha moment, but because they're a historical opportunity. Because if we don't understand what happened, we will repeat it.
First of all, I agree 100%. Secondly, when you listen to the right talk about protesters obliterating our heritage, I mean, one, we all know it's racist code. But secondly, this is a massive correction that's going on of a propagandistic history and a history that's just wrong. To think about statues to people who declared war on America in order to be able to continue to enslave people, that anyone anywhere would want a statue of such a person who caused hundreds of thousands of deaths in order to keep people in chains, that those statues would be dotting our public parks all over the country. It's a horrible thing. All of this reminds us that we have to do a better job of teaching our history. By the way, in some future show, I hope we spend most of it on foreign policy, because it's the other thing that gets kind of left behind. Much of the progressive agenda is in great shape with great public support, just a Democratic, a Biden and a few more Democratic senators, and we can implement it. Foreign policy, like corruption, is partly left behind. And if we knew that real history, if America knew that its own government had secretly, violently deposed the democratically elected government of Iran, and that's the main reason everybody in Iran hates us. Right. Everybody in Iran knows it. Most people in Europe know it. The only place you could go where people don't know about it is here. And so our need to just teach, not to blame, not to blame America, just so we know what we did. And when it's out in the open, when we make foreign policy in the open, we tend to do good things. And when we make it behind closed doors, we tend to do things that shame us.
And I'm going to go back, because I got to let you go. I'm going to go back to what just happened in New York, and that's Bowman's defeat of Engel. Engel was the head of, the Foreign Policy Committee.
Absolutely.
And just by his removal, we already have an opportunity. I don't know who's going to replace him, but right there, at least if nothing else, that chunk has been removed. Now the question is, you know, are we going to see a more informed Pelosi? Who knows? Is she going to be the speaker in the future? Who knows? But if nothing else, there is an opportunity for us to say, okay, our next choice, what will we be talking about and who will we choose?
And that's a great suggestion, Artie. And again, having a specific question about who takes that mantle.
Exactly.
And by the way, in the Senate as well, it's harder to get your choice in. But in both places, someone who was honest and a little more progressive and ready to renounce the utilization of violence and the resolution of human conflict would just be a revolution unto itself.
People are policy. People are policy.
Yes.
Now I have a person that we can actually say, and who's going to replace him? And on that note, no one is ever going to replace Bill Curry.
Everyone
in the great state of Connecticut. He is one of the best progressive commentators in the country. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kit. Talk to you soon.
All right, Joe. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Stephanie Collins, and Dave Scott, my great producers. Talk to you next week. Thank you.